Hey guys, hope you're enjoying the podcast. As always, obviously, I'm sure if you're following me on social, you know about this, but if you don't, I am doing Tea with Gary Vee. I've been doing it for about a month. It's been remarkable. If you're not following it, you're making a huge mistake. 9 a.m. Eastern time during this crisis, we're doing some incredible stuff. Please check it out. Tea with Gary Vee, live on all my social platforms every morning at 9 a.m. Twitter is definitely the place that you can't miss it. In general, I think if you're not following me on Twitter, it's a huge mistake. Gary Vee on Twitter. Check it out.
This is the Gary Vee Audio Experience.
He is Gary Vaynerchuk. So give it up for Gary Vee. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Want to thank my mom for writing that intro.
Well, it is great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Truth, I am a big fan and a follower, so it's thrilling to be able to sit here and ask you a few questions
today.
So just so you guys know the format, we'll spend about 40, 45 minutes together going back and forth a bit. And then we'll open it up for Q&A for about 15 minutes. So get your questions ready. But I thought maybe we could kind of open it up and maybe explore a little bit more about your background. I
mean, okay.
You have the classic entrepreneur story, as I understand. You came to America at the age of 3, selling lemonade and trading baseball cards at the age of 6, to now really building a media empire. So maybe for those who aren't as familiar with your story, can you just take a moment to share some background?
I don't want to take up too much time because I want to get into the meat, but it really is an old school story, probably one that's more similar to a lot of people that came over from Eastern Europe in the 30s and 40s, more so than in the 70s. Came over super poor, you know, 10 family members in a studio apartment in Queens, real, real difficult times. My dad got a job as a stock boy in a liquor store in New Jersey, and that's really, in essence, where the American dream started. He eventually became the manager. How many people here, by show of hands, are either immigrants or children of immigrants? Just raise your hands. So what you definitely know is immigrants have an incredibly interesting hack. It's called make money, save it, spend nothing for a decade, and buy something. And that's what my parents did, and my dad eventually owned a liquor store. I was very natural entrepreneur, lemonade stands. I'm 43, so the baseball card boom in America happened when I was a teenager. I was making $3,000-$4,000 a weekend selling sports cards at 13. And then my dad dragged me into the family business and I stocked shelves and made ice for $2 an hour. And somewhere around 16, fell in love with the idea of people collected wine the way that I collected sports cards. And basically I traded in the Beckett baseball card guide for the Wine Spectator and Robert Parker. And by the time I was 18, from a knowledge base, I knew way too much about wine without ever drinking it. And then launched one of the first e-commerce wine businesses in America in 1996 called winelibrary.com, and built my dad's business from a $3 to $60 million business in a 5-year window with no cash infusion, with no credit line, on basically what is now my life's thesis, which is when you are actually consumer-centric and when you actually understand what's happening at that exact moment, there is an incredible arbitrage around that attention graph to grow businesses. And that's what I spend my time on.
That's great, that's great. I mean, you have clearly been so successful, but would love to understand a little bit more about what does success really look like for you, and you know, how do you even really define it? Because
for me personally as a human, it's happiness, and for me happiness is, are the 10 people that I love the most healthy today? And then after that, am I able to wake up in the morning and do what I want to do and have full control? And the answer is yes, and that's why I'm wildly happy.
Yeah, no, that's great, that's great. One thing that really strikes me when I follow you is just that you're so incredibly passionate and inspiring and driven, and where does that come from?
Gratitude. I'm wildly grateful. I think you've already heard. I mean, I'm an entrepreneur, and I was born in the Soviet Union. And for me to be able to get out of the worst place for entrepreneurship and come to the best place of entrepreneurship and live out my life, there's a, and then having the parents that I had and in the cadence that they parented me, I always make the joke that if my mom basically, you know, my dad worked every minute. I spent maybe I mean, I maybe spent less than 25 hours of remembering time with my dad until I was 14. He was never around. He was building our dream. He would leave before I woke up and he got home after I went to sleep. Even though he was in my house every day of my childhood, I never saw him. My mom is the most incredible mother because she instills wild amounts of self-esteem but doesn't go into the land of delusion and entitlement. So it's self-esteem with consequences, which is something I think parents are struggling with over the last couple of decades. And so I have this incredibly amazing all-time mom. And then I get my dad, who really took the bull out of me. I was such a good gift of gab kid. I would do anything to sell. And my dad thinks embellishment is like deep lying. So he kind of tweaked me and made me straight. And so I'm just grateful that not only did I have my natural DNA, the circumstances that allowed me to come to America, but then if my parents switched and my dad raised me until I was 14 and my mom took me over, I would be an awfully unhappy, broke person. And instead I get to be the reverse, and so I'm grateful for how it kind of worked out.
Yeah, yeah.
And that level of guilt, because you know so much is the luck of the DNA roulette, and circumstance and the gratitude has created this last chapter of my life where I want to articulate value to at scale through these channels because I think the world is abundant and I don't hold on to my best ideas. I scale them, and getting the emails or the people stopping me at an airport who've been affected by it in a positive way, that level of admiration is far more interesting than the couple extra zeros I could have had by keeping it to myself.
I mean, your values are so core to who you are, and we'd just love to better understand and explore your own value system, you know, and how you think about that, and how has that really influenced your outlook on life and how you've built these businesses?
My mom really rewarded through words anything that was kind. I remember this one thing very vividly. Yeah, it's worth clapping for. I remember us losing a baseball game and I was super sad because I'm wildly competitive. And we went to McDonald's because my mom was trying to make me feel better and it was very rare for my mom to spend money on anything. So a Big Mac was like a Ferrari. And so we're going to McDonald's and I remember this so unbelievably. It's like 1984, I must, you know, maybe nine. I opened the door for this woman. You would have thought that I won the Nobel Peace Prize. My mom spent so much time reinforcing kind and empathetic and generous behavior that it just became my framework. Like, I call VaynerMedia, my company, the honey empire. Honey over vinegar, but empire. And finding that balance, which I think we struggle with in our society, definitely in the business world, I believe the far majority of the people in this room are CFO-driven organizations, and they're just willing to do whatever it takes to hit numbers quarter by quarter, and I, because I'm trying to build things in perpetuity, not to flip or to appease Wall Street or to hit bonuses, have the luxury. I don't judge, I just think it's the truth of the business world. I get to go with a much more EQ retention framework, which at its worst, and I've had moments where I've lost control, it becomes wildly entitled. And then you have to let go of C players who are sweethearts and everybody gets mad at me. And at its best is how you build meaningful companies.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and also one thing I've really picked up in listening to your podcast is you're this internal optimist, right? And when things are going well, I always say, you know, that's pretty easy, but it's hard to stay optimistic in the face of adversity. And we just love any, you know, any thoughts or techniques or how you...
It's so funny you're saying this. I have a lot of startups, I'm an investor in boards, and obviously my own executives, and I keep yelling since the economy's been so good for so long, and I don't know when it's gonna go, but I've definitely been chirping, like, it's very easy to be a peacetime general. You know, you're soon gonna have to be a wartime general, and do you have the stomach for that? And so, yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a level of optimism and delusion that any entrepreneur mixes within their DNA. I also wildly like losing. And let me quantify that. I like the process. If the economy collapses tomorrow and my business suffers, I haven't been doing the right things for the last 3 years to prepare. I deserve to lose. I I think you, what I really struggle with capitalism and entrepreneurship is people love it when it's benefiting them, but then they want to change the rules when it's not. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, if I get smashed or get put out of business, I deserved it. To me, when I'm 80 and there's a young lioness biting at my toes, like, she should win. I shouldn't use politics or some other game to stop it. Like, the game is the game, even over my own benefit. And so I don't get scared of bad times because I think that's when the best players rise. I mean, I'm uncomfortably confident for our next economic downturn. Wow. All my behavior is predicated on it. I sit on way more cash than my advisors want to. I'm building a company that brings way more ROI in return for what they spend than the competitors. So when stuff is hard, they'll have to be smarter with their money. The consumer never changes its behavior during downtimes, even though people think that. So I keep leaning into that. So, like, to be frank, I hope we all walk out of here right now and the stock market goes in half.
God, I hope not. But
I do. I really do. I really genuinely do. I feel most comfortable in carnage. I think I think it's also important. I mean, I think it's important for everybody in this room. Like, look, everybody in this room, you've got a half a brain at least if you're in this room. And what I mean by that is, it's been good for a long time. You know, presidents on both sides of the aisle have continued to leverage our future to keep it good for, like, eventually that falls. And if you're sitting in debt or overextending yourself, that's your fault. I love when people are like, what happens when, you know, driverless trucks come and put these people out of business? I'm like, it's gonna take 11 years, and if you've been hearing about it for 11 years and you did nothing about it, you should die.
Okay.
One way or the other, the truth always wins in the end.
Yeah, it's true.
And so I think a lot about that. And so I think good behavior and that's what leads me to consumer-centric mentality. I think one of the real stunning things of getting into professional land outside of family business, outside of startup investing, is most people say they're consumer-centric, but they're actually not. Like, the person that hates me the most is my CFO. And that means I'm running a very smart business. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, 98% of the companies in this room are run by CFOs, not the CEO.
Let's talk a little bit about you as a leader.
Okay.
Right? I mean, you're a leader of your own company and many businesses you've helped build. So what would you say are some of the key lessons you've learned along the way that maybe you could share with the many leaders that are here in the room with us today?
You know, I think, first of all, you need to lean into your strengths. You know, I'm far more an HR-driven CEO than I am a CFO-driven CEO, and that means, even though I just made these jokes, I really look for competence in my CFO. Mm-hmm. Now, I always think that if you're a leader, you have to be dangerous enough in every discipline to succeed. So I know how to, you know, my CFO, who's great, Alan, he's amazing, you know, sometimes likes to razz me because he's really, and I'm very gray and on the offense, and I love to tell him, like, hey, I've been running businesses since I was 22 years old and I've made payroll every single week of my life. So I'm not being crazy, I'm just on the offense. I know that voice is emerging as a platform, so I'm gonna invest in it. It's not gonna look good this year when we lose money because nobody wants to buy it yet, but I'm gonna make the investments to take care of the growth that's gonna happen in 3 years. That's actually a good job by a CEO. That's not a bad job as long as you can afford growth. So, you know, to me, I think it's leaning into strength. I actually think the number one attribute of a great leader is self-awareness. You know who you are versus who you wish you were is just a really good thing to think about. Like, I'll give you a good one. Right now, obviously, over the last decade, especially over the last 5 years, people always ask me, like, oh, do I have to make content on LinkedIn? Do I have to be a personal brand? You know, all that kind of stuff. And the reality is, absolutely not. There's so many people that run tremendous companies that are super hidden. Obviously, I'm a little bit more outward, but that's just one big game of self-awareness. I mean, most people shouldn't be producing content. They're quite boring and distracting. And so, you know, I think that it's self-awareness. And then I think, look, I think I have the luxury by you know, being an independent company with no board and nobody who has any say to, you know, be able to lean into long term. I think that more people here should acknowledge the truth of what the North Stars of their decision makings are with the people that they lead. I think a lot of people disguise that they're trying to make this number this quarter instead of making their team a part of it and being transparent. They try to make pretend that's not what's happening, which is the quickest way to lose trust with your team because they know. Mm-hmm. And so just more candor, you know, more candor.
Yeah, no. You're starting to go there, and I want to shift the conversation a little bit about culture.
Okay. You know,
we talked a little bit about this backstage, and we had a lot of conversation this morning, right, about the importance of culture and taking the time to develop and foster a culture inside your own company. And
yep.
Certainly at Microsoft, you know, getting our culture right
yeah.
and getting it healthy was foundational to our transformation, you know, absolutely. And so, number one, do you believe this? Which sounds like you absolutely
yes.
do. But what kind of culture do you really work on to create inside of your own environment, your own company?
At our best, what I've come to realize very recently, actually, is I'm super passionate about eliminating fear. Hmm. I have seen some things recently that just, I'll give you, this is real life, big opportunity with Procter & Gamble. I tell the lead, hey, this is a huge opportunity. Let's go crush this and we can mm-hmm. grow next year. He passes this on to somebody else. The next thing I know, that person is telling their team, if we don't crush this, we're all fired. And I'm like, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
So I've been spending a ton of time on being in the trenches with 1,000 people that we have across all these offices to continue to try to eliminate fear. Mm-hmm. To me, that is wildly important. Speed,
mm-hmm.
you know, I just was on a conference call. I just landed from New York at SFO, and the first phone call I made was talking to 20 executives working on a big project. I'm like, I want no meetings, none. And if you have them, make them like 8 minutes. I mean, the amount of meetings everybody in here is having that are actually 9-minute meetings, but they're turned into 1-hour meetings of straight garbage talk. So, speed,
mm-hmm.
Speed, lack of fear, and just long-term thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I pump so much propaganda, AKA truth, of like, I'm trying to keep people forever. Like, I want you to work here for 27 years.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, I'm a very, very sad New York Jets fan right now, because I was there last night to the end, because I watch every play, knowing I had this early flight this morning, wanting to, who knows what I wanted, but nonetheless, but in, you know, it's ironic, the Jets are having an atrocious season on my biggest thesis about companies, which is, I believe in continuity on the offensive line more than anything, and I know I'm getting very nerdy and you'll have to like football to understand this, but I'm fascinated by companies not retaining talent over small amounts of money, because then they have to pay recruiting, they have to go through a process, but most of all, forget about that usually nets out to be a loss, it's just getting teams to have a cadence with each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like an offensive line that's played together for 3 years. Everything's just simpatico. And so I love continuity, mm-hmm. and so by eliminating fear, by trying to get good behavior around speed and other things, we can do what we need to do, and then most of all, I speak in perpetuity
mm-hmm.
for the company I'm building, for how long I want people. And then when you do that, you actually start caring deeply about people. You start actually worrying about, do they want title? Because they're insecure and they like throwing it around. Do they want money? Because they have to buy a fence at home. Do they just want new challenges? Do they want to live somewhere else? And so I believe in listening
mm-hmm.
and trying, again, going back to fear, all I'm trying to do is get people to tell me the truth. I keep trying to tell them, look, I'm the logo. I don't care if you hate everybody, including me. I just need the data so I can make a logo decision, and I believe in that.
Yeah. When you think about it, also the culture that you create with your staff. How do you balance, you know, praise and feedback?
Poorly. I'm not good at that. I'm atrocious at it. It has been the single biggest challenge in my life. I suck at radical candor, and have only gotten decent in the last 3 to 4 years after having to pay the price 5 years ago of having a series of layoffs that completely destroyed my company for 6 months because everyone was so angry at me. Because I used to blame them. I'm like, man, you really stink at your job. But I was unable to actually give you radical candor, which made you delusional. And then when I fired you, you were stunned, and I was stunned that you're a human and didn't realize you sucked. I'm really grateful. My brother's 11 years younger than me. When he came into the business, we started the business together. My dad was a Soviet. I think naturally I could have been okay at it, but what happened was I had a father who ran his liquor store like it was the Soviet Union. Literally the first thing my dad told me when I was 14, as I'm walking into the store for the first time in my life, was the employees are your enemy, watch if they're stealing. So, and he's also a barker and not a biter, and I'm a non-barker and a biter. So I overreacted to him criticizing everything. And so I think my natural state is not to over-communicate negativity, and I think I got even groomed in a way that pushed me even further. And that has been the great challenge. Praise is easy for me. Mm-hmm. I'm giving people praise like my mom did with the door at McDonald's. You know, people showing up to work, I'm like, good job, Johnny. You know? But that created delusion, and I needed to correct that, and I've gotten I got solid at it. I'm getting better at it. It's something that's super important. Listen, the biggest issue with us socially is that we're on tilt in opposite directions, and everyone's just going one step further in each direction. And until we have a moment that brings us back to the center on both sides, we'll have an issue. And that's how I think about praise and radical candor. Like, you've got to find your balance. And most people, I think, I mean, look, we just went through we do review cycles twice a year. It's literally the most depressed I am. Humans are just bad at communicating. Like, reviews are the worst. Like, I remember one kid coming out of a review, he was like top 10 performer, but because the person reviewing him or the team reviewing him wants to give some critical feedback so you can work on it, they're super passionate about delivering that, but they glossed over the fact that he's dominating. And some people are insecure and that's all they can hear. I've been really trying to 360 reviews make me vomit. Just haven't figured out the alternative, so I have to stay quiet about this issue. It's a balancing game.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm gonna talk a little bit more about people and very specifically hiring. I think it's something we all sometimes struggle with. You know, how do you hire the best people out there, right? So what characteristics do you look for when you hire people?
You can see I'm excited about this question. So hiring is something I'm wildly fascinated by. I am shocked by how many people have ego wrapped up in hiring well, which then means they don't fire. Mm. People right now in this room are not firing somebody they hired because they don't want to take the L in hiring. So my big thing is guess on hiring and fire fast. Hiring is guessing. You know how many references I've reached out to in my entire career? Really? I'm gonna call somebody that you front-loaded? I don't have time to hear a PR, and more importantly, I have given great references 100 times in my life for people that suck crap. Because I'm kind, and I'm like, I don't want them to be on the street, and I don't care about your company, so yeah, they're the best, they should be the CEO. And everybody here has two. So I go on intuition on hiring. And hiring is guessing, firing is knowing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How long does it take you to come up with an impression of a person that you're gonna hire?
17 seconds. I mean, sometimes it's super fast.
Yeah.
Not a lot, you know, not a lot. It also massively backfires. A couple years ago, I hired a super senior executive, literally 45 minutes into his first day, I'm like, oh, crap. Took me 3 months and a lot of severance because I felt bad, but that sucked. So look, I think this goes back to self-awareness. If you're a student kid and you like to go through that process, mazel tov, do your thing. For me, I think it's very much been proven that, you know, hiring is a crapshoot. And I actually think we need to have much more thoughtful concepts around firing. Being more decisive, but then if you're decisive, being kind to the person you're being decisive to. Mm-hmm. Like the amount of times I've sat on decisions for 9 months where I would have wished I just let them go after 2 months and gave them 7 months of severance is something that I've adjusted to. Mm-hmm. Imagine only working somewhere for 2 months and getting 7 months of severance if you didn't have that kind of contract. That's a good gig, you know, and everybody would have been happier. Yeah. And so I think there's a lot of things we've accepted that are wildly wrong. And we need to start debating them. And I think hiring and firing is way up there.
Yeah. Recruiting. So how do you think about recruiting, especially when you think about kids coming out of school? Do you feel you need to recruit from the top schools? Or do you feel?
No. Those kids, current good student kids are, well, that's not fair. I think it's what are you recruiting for? I don't think the top schools are a tremendous indicator because I think college is a business. And I think, at best and at worst, I think we've seen the headlines. So I think recruiting is actually a content media strategy. Hmm. I think companies need to create relevant content for the end consumer that they're reaching, so youth, and that's where I think big companies are failing. Hmm. I think big companies need to make creative in places where this talent lives. Mm-hmm. And so these kids have so many options. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say 30 to 40% of this audience, if they were 22, would start a business now today instead of going the route they went. Now, a lot of people will fail because right now we're living through the greatest era of fake entrepreneurship. But I do think there is incredible practicality to starting a business that allows you to make $200,000-$400,000 a year. Everybody's like, Billy or bust, that's crazy. Everybody thinks they're building Instagram, that's crazy. But there's a wild practicality around making $200,000-$400,000 a year in a business around your deep passion of golf or cooking or sneaker culture. And I think when we get to the maturity of that conversation instead of the extremes, I think it's gonna create options that's gonna make recruiting dramatically higher in a decade than it is today. Mm-hmm.
Going a little bit deeper in education, do you believe that schools are equipped to really train students to work in this new world of digital?
No.
Yeah.
No. Mm-hmm. No, I do not.
Can you elaborate?
I don't believe a single person in here believes that to be true. Mm-hmm. Honestly, who here thinks any school, the school system that we have, both public and private and university, is actually, do you guys know what they teach in advertising school? Print. No, I do not. I think the world is too fast paced, and I think the education industry is actually a tremendous disguise for a business that has zero feelings towards its user. Hmm. I believe in education. I do not believe the way it's sold.
Hmm. Hmm. Shift gears a little bit, and I would love to have a conversation a little bit more about disruption, right? There's a lot of companies that are being disrupted these days, and so can you give an example on when you disrupted something? Maybe it was a business, an industry, kind of a way of doing something, and what that was like?
Yeah, I mean, that's really been my whole life and the two core things I've operated, and now I'm doing it in the sports representation business with my brother, with VaynerSports. Actually, it's the only thing I want to do. Every industry's leaders are focused on the short-term ROI and not the reality of the end consumer, and that's why they're always vulnerable. So everything will be disrupted, especially because the internet is the middleman. And everything, you know, we got to bookstores, we got to limo services, we're gonna go to a lot more things. I disrupted the wine business very aggressively. Mm-hmm. When I got into it, Sherry Lehman's, K&L, Wine Club, you know, Zaki's, you know, Sam's in Chicago, those were the leaders. They all did full page New York Times ads and they all did catalogs, and I started emailing people and I built one of the fastest businesses in the industry with no money, because I understood that people wanted email, not 80-page catalogs, and the cost of me reaching consumers was zero, and the cost for them was like $6 a unit. And by the time you got your catalog with Opus One or Dominus, I already sold it to you 3 weeks earlier. And so, and then I did it with Google search. You know, I owned every wine term you could imagine for the first year for five, and then when they made it 10 cents minimum a click. And then I disrupted it again when I started a wine show in 2006 on YouTube, as soon as YouTube came out, where I really, really was excited because, did anybody here watch Wine Library TV by any chance? I know it was like, thank you, Mom. So it was a real big hit in 06, 07, 08. Most people just weren't consuming video online, but that was exciting for me because I really got to do what I wanted to do, which is, I don't know if you guys know this. How many people here by show of hands are either into wine or have somebody they're close to that's fairly into wine? Raise your hands. Great, so you guys know this truth about the wine industry, which is the second somebody gets even a little bit of knowledge about wine, they become a straight jerk. So I wanted to debunk it, and I knew that I sat on a huge knowledge base, and I knew that I could taste blind with the best sommeliers in the world. Wow. And I also knew that I was going to refer to wine with references to Hillbilly Jim and Big League Chew and racquetballs, and I knew that I could change the culture. And there was a really incredible article written about a year ago about this group of sommeliers that now live on Instagram and really the decentralization of wine criticism, and it sped back to what I did, and that feels great, and I'm doing it in the ad world. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am publicly screaming from the top of my lungs on Madison Avenue that no brand in the world should buy a television commercial outside of the Super Bowl. That is not what the industry believes. And so we've disrupted it, we're growing very quickly, and we will be wildly historically correct because it's based on consumer behavior, not of my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any lessons you can share or advice you can give to this audience about how to go about disrupting other industries that they're in?
Courage and patience. Do you know how many people in this room sit in a meeting and don't agree with it but don't say anything because it's detrimental to their short-term career? All of them. And I respect it. I don't say it as a razz. I have a ton of empathy for it. I just also think it's not a good idea. I think you should die on your own sword. And I think there's a respectful way to push back in meetings that I would love to encourage you to do, because I'll tell you what's gonna happen. If you're actually right, it's such a growth for you. And it's more fun to die on your own sword. Being a yes man and woman man in a company, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then that company strategy was wrong and you knew it, and then you take the fall, sucks. Leaving your two cents on the table respectfully, and then when it falls and somebody gets a different job and you get promoted three prongs because you said the right things in the room, fun. If there's anything we talked about so far, that would be the thing that I would most want people to repeat in their mind, knowing the makeup of the majority of the room. That has been glorious for me. I've had the luxury of being an entrepreneur, so there was no getting fired, so I didn't have to be respectful with my feedback. But everything I've built in the ad world over the last half decade has been completely predicated on being historically correct and not believed at the time. Mm-hmm. We win very little business up front.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that I, you know, in watching your podcast is and just watching how you interact with people, you inspire so many. And I know you're inspiring many people here today. And so what I'm curious about is, where do you get your source of inspiration from, or who?
My circumstances, my parents, like, we kind of started with it. I'm just wildly aware. 400 trillion to one. If you like math in here, that is the math that is accepted by current scientists about the likelihood of being a human being. Let's just play with that for a second.
Wow.
You are more likely to win the lotto five times in your life than have a life. I don't think we have a good perspective on life. I think people struggle with their relationship with time. Like, watching 54-year-old, you know, executives, entrepreneurs, parents, humans, like, mentally wrapping it up when they're gonna live another 50 years makes no sense. And I'm watching it every day. Mm-hmm. You know, watching 28-year-olds freak out that they're gonna be 30 in 24 months and they don't have their act together makes me vomit, you know? So I don't think people have a good perspective of time. And I also don't think that people actually are grateful. Let's call this what it is. Everybody sitting in this room right now is ranking in the 7.7 billion people that live on Earth. I'm talking full circumstances, opportunity, wealth, health, happiness. Like, can we all just agree that we're sitting way up there? Honestly, and then we complain about like the wrong milk in our Starbucks. We are not driven by gratitude. Mm-hmm. We are wildly missing the point. And so for me, I'm inspired by the perspective I was gifted for whatever reason, because I take no pride. You know, one of the things that's really fun about the way I'm navigating mm-hmm. is all the accolades, all the growth that's been going on. You know, that's not me. Mm-hmm. That's my parents had sex at the right moment. Honestly, like what did I do? You know, so to me, my businesses, my kids, I feel a little more pride in, but it's really easy to be grounded in humility and conviction at the same time when you actually realize, as great as you think you are, as great as things are going, as much ambition, and honestly, I'm 43 years old. I have, you know, 40, 50, 60 years of push, like I haven't even started. I will buy the Jets, I will win a Super Bowl. I believe that. And that will be a great story because I predicted it. And so but even in all that, I just don't think that I'm driven by life. You know, as many social things that are happening that disturb me, I keep reminding my friends who get a little bit off tilt, I'm like, look, people had to go through the Black Plague. You know, like real life. You know, my great grandparents buried themselves alive because of Nazis. Like, yes, there's plenty of things to worry about, but I'm an optimist. I believe in humans, mm-hmm. and we should. We've had bombs that can wipe us off the face of the earth for the last 70 years, and we're sitting here. Like, we've got something in us collectively. Mm-hmm. There's always outlying actors and actresses, but I'm optimistic. I think there's a ton of opportunity.
Yeah, I love it. I guess my last question, please. I think, is quite fitting right now, and then we'll open it up for your questions. You know, what legacy? You've done so much, right? You've accomplished so much already, and you're so inspiring just sitting here listening to you, and just what legacy would you want to leave?
I'm very passionate about being thought of in 60 years when I go as somebody who gave more than he took. Mm. I'm passionate about that. You know, I want to redefine entrepreneurship. I believe that I'm so proud that I'm watching alpha males specifically, but also women, but watching alpha males in their 20s on their Instagram start to use words like empathy and gratitude and kindness is absolutely shaping up to be one of my true legacies. And I couldn't tell you how proud I am of that, because those were not words coming out of those characters a decade ago. And being a champion of that framework, being a champion of warmth and EQ, while still being somebody who wants to kill everybody in this room. I mean it. I think about it like sports. I think, actually, this is a really good way to put it. I've been thinking a lot about this. We need a conversation in the business world that looks like sports. Here's what I mean by that. When you think about athletes, how hard they go, they're willing to trip you, they're trying to win. But when the game's over, there is that ability to be cordial, shake hands, talk about families. We have not been able to separate business from humanity. Like, I really genuinely want to destroy all my competitors, not at their detriment, health, or real life-wise, just the spirit of the game. But I want to do it, and we talked about this backstage, my favorite saying in business is, there's two ways to build the biggest building mm-hmm. in town. A, just build the biggest building. Or B, tear down everybody else's buildings. And I watch most people tear down everybody else's buildings. And I'm extremely proud that my entire career, and definitely until the day I die, will be strictly about building the biggest building. And if somebody outbuilds a bigger building, I applaud them, because they deserve it. Mm-hmm. I was an investor, early investor, angel. I did well. You heard some of the companies. I did extremely well. But Chris Sacca and Scott Belsky and others did better, and I say it publicly, and they deserve it. They made better decisions. They took smarter meetings. They didn't pass on Airbnb like I did. They did things. You know, like, they did things, and they deserve it. I'm not happy about it. I'd like to elbow them in the mouth and make them bleed. but I respect it, and we've lost a little bit of that. And I don't know if we've ever really had the proper conversation about it's okay to be competitive and really win, but you can also do it in a kind manner. Honey, empire. And those are two very specific words for me. Honey, empire. And we need that, because I think when you go to one way or the other, one leads to terrible behavior that we all frown on, but we need to be very careful about too much honey, because then you lead into eighth place trophies. Then you lead into quietly paying for your kid's life when they're already 32. Listen, I get tens of thousands of DMs from kids that are in their 20s and 30s that have deep underlining resentment and depression because their parents are quietly paying for their lives. Which I then tell them, like, don't take the money, jerk. But there's almost nothing worse than a parent subsidizing secretly their child's grown-up life. It will eventually be exposed and talked about, and I can't wait, because a lot of the underlining depression that is confusing people is actually coming from those sources. And it's even scarier when you dig underneath it, because what you start realizing is parents want to posture in front of their friends that little Sally and Johnny are doing well, and that's why they're riding a BMW or have a business, when quietly they're the ones paying for it. If you don't stand on your own 2 feet and you're a grown-up, you will be sad.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I watch a lot of my friends criticize venture capital and Wall Street, but then they're doing the same thing with their children. Mm-hmm. That hypocrisy needs to be fixed.
Yep. Well, now it's time to open up. Let's hear what our audience has to say, what's top of mind. And so I think our hands are going up quickly. We have some microphones.
Great.
So we can all hear you.
Here they come.
There you go.
Number one. Good.
Yeah. Gary V.
Yes, sir.
Read your book 2.5 years ago, crush it, listen to your podcast, your YouTubes, not as much anymore.
Great.
I'm a father now.
I get it.
Gotta suppress the energy.
I get it.
Love the fact that you didn't curse this entire session. That's
they
incredible.
Made sure of it before I got on stage. I was trying.
I'm a data and artificial intelligence specialist at Microsoft. Love Microsoft. When I started listening to your stuff, I was always trying to figure out a way for me to give back, be some kind of a thought leader in the space, didn't like to create content. Listening to your stuff constantly really gave me courage. This entire talk track about empathy, literally I've listened to all your stuff.
Thank you.
You mentioned something one day, I was listening to your Daily V podcast, you talked about intrapreneur.
Yes.
And I've always been so scared about being an entrepreneur.
Yes.
And you were always saying, hey, being an entrepreneur sucks, bleep.
Yep.
A lot of work, and I was always trying to fill in the blank, like, why can't I want to be an entrepreneur, get into venture capital, do all these things that my friends were doing and weren't happy doing. Finally figured out this intrapreneurship thing. I work at Microsoft, creating content. I just did a LinkedIn Live today with Ken Miller on the leadership team. I love it.
Good
love entrepreneurship. What do you think about entrepreneurship? What do you think about managers and these different, you know, mid-level, high-level managers at these different organizations, what they should be?
I'm a big fan of it. I actually think of it very similar to people that are franchisees. If you're a franchisee, you've got entrepreneurial tendencies, but you're not all the way there, right? You're doing it with training wheels. And I think entrepreneurship's the same way. There's something in your DNA that likes the comfort of not being 100% always on to create the base of the financial needs you want, plus the teamwork and all those other things, and that's great. And I think it's fantastic. The one downside of it is entrepreneurs often get their wings clipped once there's momentum. That's the nature of being within a company. And there's nothing wrong with that either. I think it's one big game of self-awareness. You have to play within a framework. There's a lot of things you're not saying that you want to say because you work in a company, and I respect that. And if that works for you, then that makes me super happy. As you can imagine, for me, I barely held off not cursing here. You know what I mean? So that's just not what works for me. And so I think it's a self-awareness game, and I'm pumped you have that. And I'm thrilled you're doing it during another golden era in Microsoft's history.
Thanks, Gary. Could I shake your hand after this little
100%.
Keynote? Yes.
Thank you. All right, number two. Yep, you.
Hello, Gary. I'm Charmian Lee. I'm 19 years old. I have a question about value. You talk a lot about value in all your content, and you and David, you guys do a great job.
Thank you.
And I just want to know, what kind of advice do you have for millennials? Because a lot of them depend on their parents and, you know, how, other than being genuine and providing value and being honest and kind, what other advice do you have for millennials and other people too?
And, definitely number one, more than anything, stop, you know, needing your parents.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, there's nothing more important than not allowing your parents to have any leverage.
Yeah.
I mean it.
Yeah.
Parents give money because they want control. So my number one advice to millennials in the way that you asked it is to not rely on parents.
Okay.
And then number two, to quantify time. We actually have our whole lives backwards. You should be doing the most high risk, high reward work from 20 to 30. The problem is that's when everybody expects you to grow up. I think, and grow up has transferred in our modern society to safe. I mean, I think that everybody under 30 should be tasting everything to get a better sense of what they're interested in. So I'd like you to call your parents and tell them, if they are, or they may not be, I don't want any more money from you.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Then I want you, and then I want you to go on a plane and go to Scotland for no reason.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Hi.
Hi. Irina Poslovsky, and I'm an entrepreneur. Can you please talk about the inspiration you had for starting Empathy Wines and why you did a subscription model for that?
Thank you. So I have a brand called Empathy Wines. I grew up in the wine business. As a kid, I definitely thought about owning a winery, but for some of the old timers in this room, it was much more Falcon Crest than it was Dollar Shave Club. And for the youngsters, there was a Dynasty Dallas-like show called Falcon Crest about a winery in the 80s. Nonetheless, it was actually very practical. I decided that I wanted to do a four-person team that acted as my chief of staff, in essence, 2 years ago. And to scale, because there was so much going on. And I took three people that had been with me for a long time and one woman that I was super infatuated with her skill set. And we had this great team. And it was an utter disaster. Because if you have four chief of staff, you have none, right? And so I needed to learn that. It seemed great on paper. And once I had that realization and I knew who should have been the chief of staff, I was left with these two executives who both started as interns at my wine businesses a decade earlier and had been at Vayner for a decade or 8 years learning the game. So I had these two great assets, these two great young individuals who were passionate about wine, who had been trained under my school, and we had been, as Vayner, really effective in growing direct-to-consumer brands in a way that was practical, not the way it's happening right now, which means, AKA, we weren't underwater in our CAC and our LTV and using funding to stay alive. We just actually knew how to do it. And so it was just kind of one of these, you know, you're in a meeting, you realize you have these two incredible people you could do something with. They have this passion. They're getting into their early 30s, thinking about what they want to do. Both started as like assistants and intern, great story that they're co-founders of this business with me. And that's really why I did it. And I sat with a lot of leverage. I knew that I could make $50 wine for 20 bucks because I could lean on my relationships at the grower levels in California, plus cutting out the middleman and the retailer created so much margin, and it's been a great experience so far. It's been a challenge. There's a lot of upfront cogs in the wine world, more so than even any other industries, because you're growing, you're farming, you're sitting on the inventory for as it sits in barrels. But it's been a great challenge. But it was really around interest and around humans and around a current skill set that we thought we had a competitive advantage in. You're welcome. Questions?
Hi, hello.
Hi.
First of all, it's an honor to hear you. We are from Mexico and we are huge fans, so we flew here to see you.
Thank you.
But I am an entrepreneur and I am very curious about all the topics that evolve like around entrepreneurship. And I have this like butterflies of trying to share it online and find a community that gives value to what I share. But I'm a bit confused about where to share it because I think that Instagram is not my audience.
Why?
Like, I don't know, it might be, but in Mexico it's a lot like fashion and beauty tips and stuff. But I want explore maybe, I don't know, LinkedIn, but I don't know if people on LinkedIn are my age. But yeah, what channels?
She called you guys old. If you're not following along. Couple things. You know, this is, and obviously if you're consuming my content, this is a question for affirmation, not information, because this is all I yell about 24 hours a day, which is create creative at scale across all platforms and eliminate judgment. All you have to do is make. You're trying to make a decision that the actions will answer for you. Why are we sitting in this hotel debating Instagram and LinkedIn? Just post and see what happens. The issue is that you're worried about the feedback. And that is what has led me to all this thinking about parenting and self-esteem and many other things, because I'm giving people literally the blueprint to success on a daily basis for free, and people are not taking it, which led me to why, which led me to the difference of being deeply having self-esteem versus actually overvaluing strangers' opinions. I mean, there's so many of you that are not posting because of strangers' opinions who have no context of who you are. It's devastating to me. I just, you know this, I'm pushing hard. Anything to encourage people to make, the chips will fall where they fall, but you have to find a relationship with judgment. Okay. You know?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, Gary.
How are you, sir?
Matthew Lombardo.
Matthew.
Used to play professional golf. Now I work for Titleist on the West Coast here.
That's awesome.
You talk about with VaynerMedia,
yes,
as far as disrupting different industries.
Yes.
I'm curious to know about VaynerSports.
Yes.
What are you doing within VaynerSports that you feel that might be a disruption that can you do differently?
We're going to care about the human. I am flabbergasted by the way the top firms in the NFL treat their kids. The second they aren't valuable, they literally spit them out. Mm. There is so little humanity and morality in the sports representation business, which is great for me because my brother and I mean, look, we're 3 years in, we represent 27 NFL players and we are deeply about to have a massive draft class because we make more money for our players off the field. We're there for them. We have a great case study right now with the current quarterback of the Carolina Panthers, Kyle Allen, who we signed when we knew he wasn't even gonna be drafted, but I just thought he was a quality kid and was like, we're here for you forever. And he was on this, a year ago, Kyle Allen was sitting on a couch watching football because he didn't get drafted and he wasn't on a practice squad. And so we're gonna, you know, it's funny, I say it in some meetings to parents, and unfortunately, 96% of kids and parents make decisions on short term, but it's probably the easiest industry of the three to disrupt because you just have to be a better human being. And I'm not even kidding. So now I just have to wait for the reputation of being a better human being to play out.
Would you move outside the NFL?
Yeah, we're gonna go into esports pretty soon. The NBA is super dirty. You have to like start paying off kids when they're like six. but we may do that just because we love it. My brother's become wildly passionate about golf in the last couple years and has absolutely debated it. And that's easy pickings. You know, my brother's really running that company. He left Vayner because he didn't love the business. So I have to be too careful to impose my empire ways on him. I mean, if I was running it full time, we'd be representing six-year-old girls who do hopscotch, you know? so we're doing it patiently, but it's an exciting thing. And what these athletes are gonna have to wake up to is, you know, most athletes do not have anywhere close to the amount of followers that like T teenage girls on TikTok have. And so they're losing their leverage very quickly, and I'm enjoying them recognizing that, because A, that's been my thesis, and B, I think we've been able to help athletes make a lot more than they would naturally get somewhere else, which in the short term, as you can imagine, is a huge advantage. We're gonna go right over here first.
Thank you.
Yes.
I think I'm probably the oldest entrepreneur in this room.
I love it. Good for you, sister.
The eighth startup. But what I wanted to say is I love the word kindness, and I want to
I noticed you clapping when I said it early on. I appreciate it.
Well, I run a charity at the United Nations besides running many businesses. But what I wanted to say in this audience, because I think it's really important, is that UCLA has just started the Institute of Kindness.
I saw that headline.
And I'm going to be working with their anthropologists, because we have a film festival we do at the UN every year for kids under 18.
Awesome.
It's called Peace in the Streets.
I love that.
And we have 700 pieces of content that we've acquired, and that's an anthropological video history of what's happened to kids in the last 6 years in the world. And so I appreciate how you deal, and I will think about it as I'm running my business. Thank you very much.
Thank you for saying that, ma'am. This last woman.
Hi, Gary.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good.
I'm a 22-year-old entrepreneur.
Real, before you go anywhere, dude, I love your mustache.
I love you,
Gary. I love you back. Thanks, bro. Go ahead.
22-year-old entrepreneur, running my own digital agency. Just started 2 years ago.
Good for you.
I just wanted to ask you your take on AI and VR and alongside of audio, and what it's going to do for the ad industry and the marketing agency in the next, or the marketing industry in the next 10 years.
In the next 10 years, I think we'll start feeling the effects of it. Meaning, and I'm guessing here, you know, and you probably know this if you follow me, like I always, people think I predict things. I don't predict things. I'm just very fast when they happen.
Yeah.
So I'm very aware of blockchain and AR and AI and machine learning and all of it. But I think people lose a lot of money being too early.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm watching them all. When you say 10 years, my intuition is 10 years from now, voice for sure. I think, you know, I know Microsoft in the macro and Amazon with Alexa and Google Home and Apple, like voice is going to be a big deal because we're lazy and voice makes it faster. We're gonna order food in our kitchen, not on our iPhone or Android device. We're gonna do so many things by talking to an AI-enabled voice machine in a decade. So to me, that's the big one. I would have been very wrong on the timing of AR, because once Pokemon Go popped, I would have thought over the last 3 years we'd have a lot of copycatting and innovation, and we've had none, which blows my mind. I would have missed that. I'm surprised. I think VR is super far away. And I tried to tell the VC community that 2 years ago, and much to the chagrin of a lot of my friends, but I ended up being very right. I mean, there's not a single person that anybody here knows that's not in the business of VR that goes home and spends an hour in VR. We're super far away. But it'll be real. I mean, I believe in the technology. I've always argued that it's going to be a contact lens before it actually becomes real. So I don't think these devices are how we're actually going to play that out. I think as a kid, you know, that's about to go through this, what you need to be careful of is not being too early, right? You know, that's, I think the thing that I've done well in building Vayner is I was exactly where the consumer was, which means the clients are 3 to 4 years behind, and you need to keep that in mind. You know, Facebook had hundreds of millions of users, and I would walk into Campbell's and Pepsi, and they'd be like, what's that? That's my daughter's thing. I'm like, no, that's where, you know, and so you make sure you get the cadence of timing right.
That's great.
Thank you very much.
We are out of time.
And clearly, you guys are turning off the lights, and like, you guys don't fool around here.
There's a little hint there.
Yeah, I'm like, scared I'm gonna get shot.
No, but I just want to take a moment to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed our interaction and the questions today. So let's give it up for Gary Vee.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. As we end today's podcast, I want to give a huge shout out to the people. You know, it's so funny. People that leave
reviews and written reviews of this podcast on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms just mean the world to me. You've taken an extra 13 to 95 seconds to show love and also give context to people of why this is a worthwhile podcast. So I appreciate that so much. And even more fun, because I think we all love a little cosign or a shout out or a little awareness, I'm gonna have the team give a couple of shout outs daily on our favorite reviews. So take it away. Which were our favorites this week?
Thanks, Gary. Today's highlighted shout out is I Listen Every Day from Dan Haley. No one provides more value than this man right here. Love him to death. Keep those reviews coming. We could highlight yours next.